Morning.
Morning.
So as I was kind of thinking this week, I was reminded of a couple of years ago. Maybe I could start with this question. How many people like doing puzzles, like jigsaw puzzles? All right, we got a few. And a few years ago, my mom came over on Christmas Eve, spent the night, spent Christmas with us. It was a good time. But one of the things we enjoyed about that time was in the living room, we set up a table and we had a puzzle. And so my wife and myself and my mom, we just worked on it throughout those couple of days. And it was a good way to slow down, to spend some time together. There's something I love about when you're just doing kind of that repetitive activity that just seems to really open up conversation. And so as it got on the last day, we were getting towards the end. It's a puzzle that had been bought, I think, secondhand, and I don't know, 500 or so. That may be an inflated guess, but something around there. And as we got towards the end, we noticed something. You may be able to guess where this is going. After 499 pieces, there was one that couldn't be found. And so much like Jesus not being able to find the one, we went looking for it. But couldn't find it. It was nowhere to be found. And how much do you think that one missing piece affected my enjoyment of doing the puzzle? A disproportionate amount. Probably way too much. After all, it is exactly 0.2% of the pieces. As far as the experience was concerned, we'd spent hours working on this thing, having a great time. Was I really missing out on that much because I didn't have the 2 seconds of putting that last piece in? It wasn't about seeing the whole picture. They put it on the front of the box. I knew what the picture was before I even started the puzzle. And yet I had trouble not focusing on that one missing piece. And today we're talking about contentment. And as I think about contentment, I think about having enough to where I am satisfied and at peace. Having enough to where I am satisfied and at peace. Ah, but here's the tricky part. What's enough? And I don't want this to be a rhetorical question. Seriously, for you, in your own mind and in your own heart, what is enough? What is the thing you need to happen in your life in order to feel satisfied and content? What is the missing piece? Over the course of my life, there have been many times where I thought I knew what the missing piece was. What was the last piece of that puzzle that I would plug in and finally complete the picture in my mind that I had of my life? I remember being in college, and at night I would sometimes go out on the football field and just sit in the bleachers. I can be moody at times. And I would just be praying for someone to spend my life with, to be a partner. I remember when I got out of grad school and I really needed to find a job that would provide for my wife and I. I remember our desire to have a home of our own. I remember our desire to have kids and years going by and not sure if that desire would ever happen. And even now I find myself a couple of years into something of a job search, and it would be so easy to think, yeah, that's it. That's the missing piece. And let's face it, all of those planning things that I'm talking about, here's the thing, all that tends to fall to the background as soon as we encounter some sort of health struggles. As soon as we're dealing with some sort of pain and we can think of almost nothing else besides just feeling normal again. or sometimes that final realization that maybe this is the new normal. We often think about contentment as a goal, as something out there, as something almost within reach, if only we can capture it. But what if that's not what contentment is at all? What if contentment is a choice we are making each and every day, each and every moment, no matter our circumstances? Our main point for today, Christ-like contentment is not a goal, but a choice. Let's go ahead and pray, and we'll get into the Word. Lord, you know how heavy it has been for me sitting under some of these passages and really just knowing there's a deep need to apply them to my own life. Lord, would we experience that conviction of your Word, but would we follow that all the way through to the freedom that it brings to our lives? Lord, would your Spirit work through your Word today? Amen. So we'll be in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Feel free to turn there. And in this letter, Paul is writing to Timothy. And Timothy's like a son to him. And Timothy is leading a group of Jesus followers. And Paul is passing along some of his hard-won wisdom to Timothy. And as we begin reading, Paul has just been writing about the fact that there are some teachers within the church who are creating controversy and division because they see their position as a means of gain, as a means of enriching themselves. I'm sure if we all sat here long enough, we could think of some famous examples of people that seem to be more interested in using their position for gain than to shepherd the church of God. And so we begin reading in verse 6. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. Paul says, do you want to know, in the midst of these teachers that are creating controversy because they're trying to enrich themselves, do you want to know what gain really is? Do you want to know what really makes a person rich? He says, it is godliness with contentment. It is to know that the Spirit is transforming us into the likeness of Jesus. It is to see the fruit of the Spirit in our lives and experience the love and the joy and the peace and the patience and the kindness and the goodness and the faithfulness and the self-control, to see that growing in our lives, to see us becoming more like Jesus in those ways, and then for that to be our source of contentment. Godliness with contentment is great gain. If we try and build our contentment on anything else, we'll find a temporary, fleeting satisfaction at best. And often not even that. Why? Because we brought nothing into the world. We're taking nothing out of the world. Okay, Paul, that all sounds great, but what does that mean in everyday practical terms? And so we come to verse 8, which for my money is one of the most challenging passages in Scripture. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. For Paul, what's the list of what I need to be content? Are we ready for it? The entire list? Food and clothing. Did I miss anything from the passage? I noticed you all wore clothes today. Thank you. You're halfway to contentment. And if you had breakfast, you made it the rest of the way. But if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. And my knee-jerk reaction is to go, Paul, are you sure? I have some things I would like to add to the list. What about shelter? That seems like a big one. That's survival 101. What about a job? What about healthcare? What about a phone and internet? And that's not even talking about relationships and security, and we could go on and on and on and on. And Paul's statement can seem so unrealistic to us. But here we encounter a problem, because it's not just Paul being Paul. This is built on the teachings of Jesus. In Luke 12, there's a long section where Jesus is kind of talking about God's provision. And the overlap of what Paul is saying is striking. And it's a long section, but we're going to read it anyway. Because we could all do with a little more of Jesus talking and a little less of me talking. Luke chapter 12, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you will eat, nor about your body, what you will put on, for life is more than food, and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens, they neither sow nor reap, they have neither storehouses nor barn, and yet God feeds them. Of how much more value are you than the birds? And which of you, being anxious, can add a single hour to his span of life?" If only I could do that by being anxious, I'd live forever. If you're not able to do such a small thing as this, then why are you anxious about the rest? Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin. Yet I tell you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass, which is alive in the field today and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, how much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? And do not seek what you are to eat or what you are to drink, nor be worried. For all the nations of the world seek after these things, and your Father knows that you need them. Instead, seek his kingdom, and these things will be added to you. Fear not, little flock, for it is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions, give to the needy, provide yourselves with money bags that will not grow old, with a treasure in the heavens that does not fail, where no thief approaches and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. There's a lot in there that I'm sure we've heard before. And a lot that we could focus on, just a couple of things. When talking about God's provision, Jesus focuses on two things: food and clothing. The same two things that Paul is focused on. But he frames it in this context that I love of, you are valuable to God. Of how much more valuable. God knows you need these things, except what are these things? Food and clothing. And it seems like even the things that we need, as short of a list as it is, are not to be primarily the thing we seek. But seek first the kingdom, and these things will be added to you. What are these things? Food and clothing. Where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be. So give to the poor. Direct your heart towards a love of God and a love of others, not a love of material things. Even those things you need. In Luke, this teaching by Jesus follows the parable of the rich fool. where Jesus warned against covetousness and kind of excessive greed. And you may know the parable, you know, a farmer, his land kind of has this incredibly productive harvest. And he has more than he can store. And so he thinks to himself, I'll tear down my barns and build bigger barns. And then I will be able to store this incredible amount, and then I'll be able to rest and relax and enjoy it. This is one of the first times it's really occurred to me that we're dealing with multiple barns here from the very start. This isn't him tearing down his shed and just needing to build something. We're dealing with multiple barns from the very beginning, and that's not enough. How many people, this is going to be a throwback. The film I Remember Mama. Anybody? Anyway, there's this. It's about a family who, is on the poorer side. And there's a scene I'll always remember because the family gathers around the table and they're figuring out the money for the month. And it's, you need this for clothing, you need this for school, this is for our bills. And they have a little bit left over, and Mama just goes, it's enough. It's enough. When we have extra, what our first thoughts are says a lot about who we are and where our heart is. I love the financial peace start and just the encouragement towards generosity. You'll notice in this parable, there's no mention of the needy. There's no mention of the community. So much of what we are given is meant to be passed along. But why? Like, God could just give to those people directly. Why is he choosing to bless me in such a way that I can pass that along to that person? Well, there's something about the opportunity for us to be generous that shapes our hearts and our minds and makes us more like him if we're willing to take that opportunity. And Jesus calls this man with the barns a fool because he's wholly focused on himself and his own enjoyment. But even in there, don't miss it, even in that, he fails. Because he doesn't know what the future holds. The future he's banking on, where he's finally going to enjoy what he's received. Even in that, he fails. Tonight, your soul is required of you. And Jesus says, do you know who is like that fool? Anyone who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards the things of God. I was talking this over with a friend, and the question came up that tends to come up. Wait a second. Is it wrong to be rich? No. No, it's not wrong to be rich. If those riches are gained in a godly manner, of course not. That's a gift from God. But what if that's the wrong question? What if that's the wrong approach? What if that's the wrong way to think about it? What if it's not about being wrong? But what if it is dangerous? I remember we kind of grew up a little bit in the country, and my brother and I had BB guns fairly early on. And we're a menace to all the tin cans around. And at a certain point, we kind of moved into a small town, and I'm sure scared the heck out of the neighbors because we're still in the backyards with our BB guns. But there was a conversation associated with that, where here is a gift, here is something that is good, here is something that you can grow from. But just so you know, this can also be misused. And you can hurt yourself, and you can hurt others. It's dangerous. For Jesus, the danger is twofold. It's trying to amass things for myself while at the same time not being rich towards the things of God. Look where Paul goes next in verse 9. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is the root of all kinds of evils. And it's through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. Notice the problem is not being rich or not. The problem is not having money or not. The problem is the desire to be rich. The problem is the love of money. When your identity, when who you are, when your value, when your security is so intertwined with your wealth, or even with wealth you don't yet have. As Jesus said, you can't serve God and money. You will identify with one or the other. You will have your identity tied up with one or the other. And people have known this. People have written books on this. People have made movies on this. There's a section in Ecclesiastes chapter 5 that always comes to mind when I think of this. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. Just ask anyone who's won the lottery. How many people show up at your door? And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Can I ask us a question? You know, if there's some material thing we find ourselves pursuing, do we really think contentment is on the other side of getting that? Really? You see, all too often, I'm preaching to myself right now. I'm preaching to my 3-year-old as I'm walking him down the toy aisle. Like, if I'm honest with myself, I know the answer to that question. I've been fooled enough times by things. But my capacity for self-delusion is impressive. John D. Rockefeller was the head of the founder of the Standard Oil Company. He was the first billionaire in U.S. history. In 1911, the Supreme Court ruled that Standard Oil was a monopoly and split it into 34 different companies, including the precursors of what today we would know as Chevron, ExxonMobil, BP, Marathon. Think about it. You found the company that even today is the precursor to pretty much the entire U.S. oil industry. At Standard Oil's peak, Rockefeller's net worth was estimated to be 1% of the U.S. economy. Which means, if you're Rockefeller, and we get 99 people in this church like you, like we could do, you have the entire worth of the U.S. economy sitting in our little church. That's money. He was asked in an interview one time, how much money is enough? And I think that's a pretty good question. I mean, if anyone knows, he's probably going to know. When did you pass that line? His somewhat famous response was this: just a little bit more. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. Can we hear Jesus and Paul on this today? Christ-like contentment is not a goal. It's not something out there. It's not something we're pursuing. It's a choice. If we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. But why is this so hard for us? What are we up against if we try and embrace this kind of contentment? Last year in 2024, $389 billion was spent on advertising in the U.S. alone. The U.S. population in the same year was 340 million. That means in 2024, $1,100 was spent on each and every one of us for advertising. $1,100 was spent on you and you and you and me and my 3-year-old and my 1.5-year-old. And companies and corporations are only spending that kind of money on us if they think they can get more from us. Have you ever just been watching a commercial and gone, who in the world is falling for this? This is the most ridiculous thing I've seen in my life. What it's promising is ridiculous. But we are falling for it. Every day. I had to kind of sit back and think to myself, when was the last time I went through an entire day without seeing a single advertisement? Between my mail and the highway billboards and my phone and my, when was the last time I went 24 hours without seeing an advertisement? It's no wonder Jesus' teachings on contentment feel so foreign to us, but also why we need them all the more. Because our consumer culture is dumping a Niagara Falls worth of gasoline onto hearts that would already be inflamed with a desire for more, no matter the circumstances, no matter the setting. And can I emphasize, just before we move on, you don't have to have money to love money. You don't have to be rich to have a desire to be rich. I've had family members at times that have just been church mouse poor. You know what I mean? Who have just been baloney poor. And sometimes you have so little money, it's all you can think about. And sometimes you have so much money, it's all you can think about. And at the end of the day, you're probably going to struggle either way. How do we embrace contentment? Because as a reminder, this sermon isn't about money or possessions or material things. This is a sermon about contentment. But we have to be aware of what's drawing our hearts away from that. And into this struggle, Paul speaks these words, if we have food and clothing, with these we will be content. So we have to be aware of the goal. Contentment is kind of connected with two other areas of life. When I think about, my own heart posture towards this, I kind of think of just a triangle with 3 points. And contentment is one of them. And thankfulness is one of them. And generosity is one of them. And they play off each other. Contentment, thankfulness, and generosity. And together they help form a heart posture towards money and possessions and relationships and everything God has given me. And those are the things that allow me to be healthy in those areas. That's the goal. But also we have to understand what's behind the goal. What's behind the goal, we're able to embrace contentment in this way because we have a good God who loves us. Who will provide for us. And that doesn't mean we don't experience hardships. It means God is working all things for the good of those who love Him. And nothing is more my good than the Spirit continuing to transform me into the likeness of Jesus. Jesus said He came that we would have abundant life. The kind of life only found in Him. The kind of life that is focused on loving relationship with God and with others. So we have to keep in mind the goal. We have to know what's behind the goal. We have to be aware of what's drawing our hearts away, even this week. Just being aware of, why am I discontent right now? What's triggered that? What's pulling my heart away from that? But I think the last thing I want us to do is come out of this message also with like, okay, here's my checklist. Here's the boxes I got to check. Here's the steps I got to do. Here's my 10 steps to contentment. It's not as hard as that. Often, the step towards contentment is just to slow down. Or to sometimes stop whatever we're doing. Contentment's not waiting out there. We don't have to chase it down and catch it. It's a choice. A choice to be free from the frantic pace. A choice to be free from the demand for more. A choice to release other people from my unrealistic expectations. A choice to realize my own limitations. A choice to sometimes just stop. To be content in the Father's love and provision. And there's work to be done. Don't get me wrong. But Jesus told us as we grow in Him, the work would be light and we would find rest for our souls. If we're not finding that, we may have added some of our own things to the work to be done. Do you want to know what that work consists of? Paul finishes with this in verse 11. But as for you, O man of God, flee these things. Flee the desire to be rich. Flee the love of money. Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, steadfastness, gentleness. We find contentment in our circumstances so that we can more fully pursue God. Contentment is not waiting for us to chase it down. It's right here, in this moment, in every moment, if we'll embrace it. I want to close with this. Toward the end of the 19th century, there was a man named Horatio Spafford in Chicago. He was a lawyer and was doing pretty well financially. He invested in a good amount of Chicago real estate, which sounds good until you realize that it's now 1871 and the Great Chicago Fire has broken out and torn through the city and burned down a third of it. And among other tragic stories coming out of that event, the Chicago Fire ruined Spafford financially. A couple of years later, Spafford was still struggling, but his family had made plans to help Dwight Moody with the evangelistic crusade in England. Spafford had a little bit of business left, and so he put his wife and four daughters on a ship and promised to follow after them shortly. And a couple of days later, he received a telegram from his wife, and the ship had sank, killing 226 people. His wife was one of the few survivors. His four daughters were not. And as you have this absolutely broken man in Chicago by himself, an ocean away from his wife, he sits down at a table and writes this. When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot God's taught me to say, it is well with my soul. I can't listen to "it is well" the same way after knowing that story. When the sorrows like sea billows aren't a metaphor, aren't pretty wording for whatever trials I'm experiencing, when the sea billows are the ocean waves that have taken four daughters from, but whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, as well with us. Contentment is a choice, and not always an easy one. But it is a choice based on a deep trust of God. Lord, you know how much you've challenged me just leading up to this. Would you just help us to sit under the words of your scripture and know that for all of this, you don't want us to be unhappy. You don't want this to be a heavy thing. You want us to move through the heaviness of realizing that everything we desire in the world is not good for us. Lord, you want us to embrace the freedom that comes from loving you and loving others. The freedom that comes from being liberated from a love of money, from a desire to be rich, from constant discontent. Lord, would you guide us in the contentment that would be a witness to those around us? In your son's name I pray. Amen. We're going to go ahead and have a video on the message for next week. And then y'all are dismissed. Thank you so much.